We get things underway this afternoon by welcoming to the program a legendary broadcast journalist, long tenure with both CBS and ABC News as both a reporter and anchor. We had a chance to catch up recently with the wonderful Morton Dean. Well, hello there, Mort. How are you today?
Rich, I am just terrific. It's good to meet up with you at long last.
Yes, thank you very much. I hope I didn't pull you away from the Red Sox game.
Well, no. I call them the beloveds. Are frequently difficult to watch, although I've been a fan for many, many, many years.
Well, there's so much to talk about in your remarkable career, but I'm going to start with something a little bit different. Knowing what I know about you, I have to ask this historical question. In March 1947, would I be correct in guessing that maybe you were at the Boston Garden watching a little basketball?
March 9th, I wouldn't know. What, the Celtics game, was it?
No, the night that Jimmy Pearsall and his Leavenworth team took it to your alma mater, Durfee.
Well, I was listening to it on the radio. Massachusetts. As a matter of fact.
Well, I thought you might have a connection to that. You, of course, went to Durfee High School, played there, I believe, captained the basketball team, didn't you?
No. Oh, I wish. That is my dream. No. I played for the JVs, was making the varsity in my senior year, and I had banged up my knee playing football, as one of my friends said. Mort fell off the bench during one of the football games. I played at Little Emerson College, and I captained the team there. But thanks, I am honored by your even believing that I have the wherewithal to captain the beloved Durfee High Hilltoppers.
Well, Emerson has got such a great tradition of producing wonderful broadcasters and actors as well. Was it there or even before that that you set your sights on a career in journalism?
It was before that because I used to hang out at one of the radio stations in Fall River, which fortunately was right next door to Doc Katz's pool hall. So I loved to play pool. And my parents didn't know whether I was going to the pool hall or to WALE, but I hung out at the radio station, and as a matter of fact, there was a hurricane coming up to Fall River and was sweeping its way up from the Taunton River, and they gave me a microphone and said, "Okay, we're going to run a wire outside, and you just stand there, and when we say go, just start talking." And fortunately, I was looking down at the windows of a furniture store, and they were undulating in and out. The wind was fierce, and suddenly the wind blew out the window, and the glass came racing up the street right by me, and I was hooked. I thought, what a wonderful career this could be.
Well, you would land a job, I believe, in Mount Kisco, New York. Now, you took some initiative that your average young broadcaster might not take. What were you, 22, 23 years old when you decided you would go to Cuba and secure an interview with Fidel Castro?
Yes, it was about that time that I really thought I had to get some bona fides on my resume that I could travel overseas. And one of the places I went there actually twice, to Cuba, and Fidel was a pitcher, you know. He was a baseball player,
right?
At least in college he was. And I brought my trusty tape recorder to a ball game. He was pitching part of a fundraising ball game. He was pitching for the Bearded Ones against another team. And I had my tape recorder, and I was with a young lady who was acting as my interpreter, shall I say, and Fidel had just wrapped up an inning, and I said, "Come on, follow me, don't stop," and I just ran down and jumped onto the field as Fidel was coming off of the mound, and I, not being very smart at the time, I had no idea that some people might think that this could be an assassination attempt, so I was surrounded by guys with... I have some wonderful photographs to prove this, by the way. And I was surrounded by guys with guns, and others were pushing Fidel away from me, and I thought my Spanish was not very good, and I just yelled at him, "Fidel, the truth, the truth, the truth." And I knew he spoke English, and it stopped him dead, and he turned around and he said, "The truth. Who wants to know the truth? What truth?" And I said, about you, and we talked for about 20 minutes. It was absolutely wonderful.
did you find him to be a very charismatic person?
Well, we knew he was, absolutely. Yeah. But he liked to talk. You know, his speeches, and I've been to any number of them over the years when I've gone back to Cuba as a network reporter. And, you know, he gets up there, and rather than speak for 10 or 15 minutes, he'll speak for 3 or 4 or 5 hours. It's extraordinary.
We're talking with Morton Dean here on Downtown. You got a very good gig back home at the legendary WBZ, and one of your early assignments was to go to Dallas in the aftermath of the Kennedy assassination. I look back on that as a very young guy at the time as a moment in our history when the media served to bring us together. It was a place where everybody gathered around in that traumatic time. How did that impact your view of your job in broadcast journalism?
Well, I look, covering a story like that, you know how exciting that can be and how it gets your juices flowing, as sad as the story was. But I was on my way up to the State House in Boston in one of those cruisers we have that had a radio in it. And I was about to drop the car off and go up to the State House and interview the then Lieutenant Governor Frank Bellotti. And I, just when I was parking the car, I was listening to BZ Radio News, of course, and they broke with the story that the president had been shot. And then a moment later that he had died, he had been killed. So I went jogging into the State House, and it was so different back then because nobody had cell phones. Mm. And there were no radios or TVs on, and there was quiet in the State House, even though the president, a native Massachusetts resident, had just been assassinated. So I went jogging up the stairs, I think it was on the third floor, into a hearing room. And the hearing had just ended, and the lieutenant governor was on the telephone, and he was seated with his press guy, and they looked up, and I shouted, "The president's been killed. He's been shot." And just as I did that, the door to the hearing room was still open. I hadn't pulled it closed, and I could hear people outside in the State House begin to shout, "Oh, no, oh, God," things like that. And bedlam, you know, was breaking loose. So later that day, my news director, a guy by the name of Ed Fooey, who was to become a great friend of mine and became an executive of mine at CBS News, died just a couple of years ago. But Ed said, "We want you to go to Dallas." And so I boarded a plane and went to Dallas. That's how I got involved in that story.
I'm glad you mentioned Ed Fooey. I wanted to ask you about him. He's one of the legendary figures in broadcasting, and you had the opportunity to work with him first at WBZ and then, of course, at the network. What did you learn from him?
We just had dinner with his widow, with his wife Barbara, the other night. She's still a good friend. Ed moved to Cape Cod, and he introduced me to the woman who is my partner now, as a matter of fact. Anyhow, I learned Ed was just the arbiter of, you know, what was real news and what wasn't. He never would accept anything that he thought was not truthful, and he would force you to prove that you really knew what you were talking about. But I have perhaps a humorous story about Ed Fooey, which goes to prove what great friends we became. He became news director at WBZ Radio. And shortly after he arrived on the scene, and I'd been working there for a short while, and we were called into the program director's office And he was a bit of a strange guy, and he had worry beads in his hand, and he was playing with those. And he told the assembled staff, which was a fairly good-sized new staff, at least back for that day, and he told us that that BZ had to contemporize itself. And beginning the next day, on the hour when we did a radio newscast, there would be a sounder, and then we were to say the time. It's 8 a.m. And then we were to say what the temperature is. You know, it's, I don't know, 67 degrees. And then we were to say what the skies, what the weather was. And then we were to say our names. I am Morton Dean, and I have news for you. Well, we all kind of gagged and said, oh, come on, you're kidding. That's crazy. And he got insulted and said, well, you're doing it. So 2 days later, I was filling in on a newscast at 8 o'clock in the morning. And Carl DeSouze was the disc jockey who did the morning. You know that name.
Absolutely.
And he said, all right, we're going to go now to the news. And it went beep. And I said, it's 8 a.m. And there was a thermometer in there connected to the outside. I gave the temperature. And then I thought, oh, my God, I don't know what's going on outside. I didn't check. But I thought that partly cloudy would be a pretty good guess. It's partly cloudy. I'm Morton Dean, and I have news for you. Well, after the five-minute newscast, I walked out into the hallway. It was a rather long hallway, and I walked into the newsroom, which was unusually quiet. And as I walked in, everybody was staring at me, and then their eyes turned to focus on Ed Fooey, the new news director, former captain of the U.S. Marine Corps. And I noticed Fooey, and he had splotches on his shirt that unmistakably had to have come from a big rainstorm. And I just stared at him, and he stared at me. And I won't use the language he used, but he said, partly blankety blankety cloudy is the worst blankety rainstorm in the history of New England. And all the eyes came back to me, and I thought rather quickly, and I pointed at him, and I said, well, you just got to get a window out in that newsroom. And he went crazy. He went absolutely batty. And I've told that story about him a million times in his company, and we were to become a great friend. But boy, that taught me a lesson. Never again.
I love it. That is wonderful. Morton Dean with us here on Downtown. You went to CBS Television, WCBS, in 1964, and then on to the network in 67. And my goodness, every time has its own share of important news stories. But I can't imagine a time in American history when there was more happening and more landmark events to cover than what you witnessed in your early years at CBS.
Yes, it was. It was a great time to be a reporter.
One of the big assignments you got was CBS spending, News. I believe, 6 months in Vietnam in 1971. A look at a world that most Americans here really didn't know about, other than the snippets from the evening news. But to see up close and personal what was going on with our people, and especially those medevac crews.
Yes, I spent a little time with a medevac crew and going out on a couple of rescue missions. And 40-some years later, maybe you're about to lead up to that, but I'll mention it. About 40 years later, I 45 years, I went back to Vietnam with my lady friend, with Mary. And when we got back from Vietnam, I got a Facebook message, and it really made me begin to believe that something mysterious is going on out there, because it had been just a couple of days after our return, and the message was from a helicopter pilot from that medevac unit saying, boy, we were just talking about you the other day. I haven't talked to him since I met him in Vietnam. And we had a reunion, and we showed the piece you had done on the Walter Cronkite show about our unit, and just wanted to check up with you. So that led to my calling him and then calling a few of the other guys and getting the idea that I ought to do a documentary about what happened, not only to the medevac crew that we flew with, but with the three wounded AmeriCal infantrymen who were rescued on one of the missions that we went on. And that documentary, which I am very proud of, by the way, I'm not patting myself on the back here, but the guys in it are wonderful. And I don't mean myself, but me. That has had, this is the second year that PBS has picked it up and it's been running on individual stations here and there. And I go around the country, a lot talking about that particular story and showing the documentary, which runs 57 minutes. And I don't know about you, but I think all of us who are in the news business or have been in the news business get captured by one or two stories that and the people in them that never leave us. And it's been wonderful for me because since I reconnected with these people, we talk not infrequently, and my partner Mary has met them. They've been to the house here and on the Cape. And well, I'm kind of babbling here.
But, no, not at all. It's a wonderful documentary.
Story.
If you get a chance to see it on PBS, American Medevac is worth your time. It is absolutely terrific. You also covered the space program. You were a semifinalist in the Journalist in Space program. I wonder, Mort, how do you view these private trips into space that some of our billionaires have set forth on here in recent weeks? Is that good? Will it kindle interest again in the space program, or would you rather that be a governmental effort?
Well, you know what I'd rather? That I had $1 billion so I could buy my way onto one of those trips. I mean, I'd be first in line. I think it is helping to rekindle interest, but not as much as there used to be, because the networks don't cover space the way we used to cover it. You know, back then we would go to every briefing. Not that they would get on the air, but we covered every technical briefing, every medical briefing leading up to a space shot, so that there were always two of us, at least each network at the time. But when I was at CBS, we literally knew everything that was going on. And when the time for the space shot came, we covered that from the beginning to the end. It was wonderful. But then somebody got the idea at the networks that people weren't all that interested any longer in space, which was nonsense, and they stopped covering it. And, you know, as with the case with most stories, if they don't get coverage, they don't get a lot of interest from the public. And I'd like to see the networks begin to cover it rather than just a brief snippet of coverage when one of these billionaires goes into space. What do you think about it?
Oh, I'm torn because I was a big fan of the space program. I for many years, I probably still can name every astronaut on every Gemini and Apollo mission. So I was a big fan, but I want to, you know, I would like to see the science still be a leading component, not just the adventure and the commerce, which some of these guys seem to be pushing.
Yes, I agree with you wholeheartedly. I still am in contact with a couple of surviving astronauts, people I covered in some detail back in the good old days. There came a time when NASA offered the networks an astronaut to sit with us on the air if we wanted to interview them and to have them guide us during our coverage. And that was just great. I loved doing that. I loved hanging out in Houston and down at the Kennedy Space Center. It was just wonderful.
I wanted to ask you about your work in 1992 covering Ross Perot's campaign for president. We've had other billionaires run for president in that time, but a very different experience. What was unique about the Perot campaign?
other than the fact that I thought he was certifiably nuts.
Well, he had that in common with some more recent billionaires.
Well, I'll leave that to you. But yeah, he was a very, very difficult guy to cover. He hated the news media. That sounds familiar. And he would not give out schedules of where he would be or where he would be or when he would be there. We'd have to coax that out of one of the staff members. And there were only a few staff members. But I had some difficult times with Ross Perot. And if you have time, I'll tell you one of the stories.
Absolutely.
I found out that that Perot had testified before a Senate subcommittee in which he told a story that was a great story, but it wasn't true. And that story had to do with the Viet Cong. He claimed and told these senators, and we got a recording of this. He told these senators that one day a team of VC gunmen invaded his Perot's property in Texas and tried to kidnap the family, and that he was the VC were chased away by Perot's guard dog. And I it was a wonderful story, and it was even written about in a book about the Vietnam War that Perot helped fund. So there it was in print too. And as I say, it wasn't true. And I was trying to figure out a way to find somebody, a responsible individual, who would say that never happened. So I was covering Perot nonstop at the time, and I had a young helper who's gone on to become a big-time reporter. And he was in Dallas full-time. And I said, go to the police station and go through the record. Perot will not say when this attack by the VC happened, but just go through the records and talk to as many cops as you can and try to see if you come up with anything. Well, he called me a few times when I was back in New York and said, you know, there are reports from the Perot family about somebody putting firecrackers in their mailbox and things like that, but there's nothing about the VC coming to shoot up the property. So I got the name of I'll try to shorten this story. I apologize for going on.
Not at all.
But I got the name of a guy who was the head of the intelligence division of the Dallas Police Department in the 60s, in the late 60s. And he was no longer with the police department, but he ran a small private detective agency in Dallas. And I called him, and he was wonderful. You know, you made these phone calls when you're not sure whether you're going to get anything, and then suddenly you realize that the person you just called is going to be your best friend. I told him, I said, look, the reason I'm calling, I'm from ABC, I was with ABC at the time. The reason I'm calling is that I've got this, I'm trying to do a report on Ross Perot and the invasion of his property by the Viet Cong, and I'll clean up the language from this cop. And he said, you blankety blank New York reporters, you believe everything people tell you. And I said, detective, you're going to be my best friend. I just know that. And I said, would you talk to me in an interview? I'd love to talk to you about that. So, you know, we found out not only from the cop, but also from the guy who was Perot's principal security guy at his house, that it didn't happen. And so Perot, I kept calling and saying to Perot's secretary, look, we're going to run this story. I'd really love to have Mr. Perot talk about it. And, he's too busy. He said to tell you he's too busy. So I finally worked the story, was ready to run on the Peter Jennings ABC News, and It was terrific. And that very day, I got a call. I picked up the phone. I was in my office in New York. And there was a very familiar-sounding voice. "Hello, this is Ross Perot. Is Dean there?" And I thought it was a friend of mine imitating Perot. Everybody was imitating Perot. And I said, "Oh, come on, this isn't Ross Perot. Who is this?" "This is Perot," he got very upset. And he said to me that the story he knew I was working on, because I had told his staff member, was not true. And he said, "If you run this story on ABC, I'm going to show that guard dog," and part of the story was there was no guard dog, "I'm going to turn up with that guard dog on NBC. I mean, he was crazy. And I said, "Oh, gee, why don't you turn up with it here tonight?" And he said, "You know what I'm going to do now?" And I said, "No." And he said, "First of all, I'm going to tell you, you ABC News must have a death wish." Sounds like a threat, right? And then he said, "I'm going to hang up and throw up." And he slammed the phone down. That's the last I had heard of him, and we ran the story. And and when I would turn up at his appearances, he was very unhappy with me. He was a very difficult man.
Mort, I wanted to ask you now, as a veteran of the business, what do you see as the state of broadcast journalism today?
Well, I think that two things. I think too many people equate talk TV and the newscast talkathons as news, when it really generally isn't. It's just people interviewing other people and nobody going out to cover the story. And I think that that bothers me a lot. I would rather go back to the old days when people covered news stories and included interviews in the news stories. I think you know what I'm getting at here. The old networks, including the World News Tonight, they rarely cover the world now. And I think that's one of the reasons why so many people dislike the news media, is because they don't really see the news, they just hear about it from talking heads. I don't know whether that makes any sense to you or not.
It does to me, absolutely.
That's my feeling.
I was a very young man. I think I was about 18 or 19. I probably looked 12 or 13, and I was doing the Sunday night local news back in the 70s when you took over the Sunday evening news.
And, where were you?
Right here in Bangor, Maine. And
how about that?
You cut a promo. Back in the day, 40-some years ago, for me, and so I appreciate that. And I wonder if
Wait a minute. I'm just going through my file. You never paid me for that, as a matter of fact.
And that's I sent that check with my guard dog. It didn't arrive. I'm just so glad Upton was able to get us together, and thank you. I hope we can do it again sometime.
Well, yes, I have a story about Upton, but I won't tell you now.
Okay. Well,
if you're recording it.
We'll have to do it again then. Definitely.
Okay.
Thank you, Mort. Be well.
Bye-bye.